Welcome back to the Mojo Podcast. It's been a while. It's good to be back here with you for Series 6. It's hard to believe that this project started all the way back in 2019. And here we are over 70 amazing conversations later. Conversations with brave and fascinating people who share revealing personal stories about their mojo, high and low, lost and found. Stories of change and transformation from a diverse group of honest guests. If you're new here, welcome. It's great to have you. I hope you love what you hear and it makes a real difference to you. If you're a listener from before, thank you so much for coming back and following your curiosity to hear some more amazing conversations. Now, for Series 6, the theme is all about commitment. I see commitment as a really powerful thing. We've all done it, we've all experienced it to some extent. Sometimes we reject it, sometimes we really, really crave it. And I wanted to get under the skin of the link between commitment and mojo. Now, often commitment seems to be something that we do or offer to someone else. It's kind of external, to your partner, to an employer. This series flips this around and asks about committing to yourself, what we choose to do and what we choose to focus on. And I've assembled an array of amazing guests to talk about commitment in this series. Commitment to community, to business, to family, to achievement, to blazing a trail. But fundamentally, it's commitment to you. And one of my key commitments this year was about bringing back the Mojo Podcast. New energy, new logo, new series. Here we go. In episode 1, I talk to the author and fellow Ibiza resident, Ben Dunwell. Ben is simply a great voice to have as the first guest for this new series. He's committed to writing a series of historical fiction set here on Ibiza called Pine Tree Island. And as he talks, you'll feel a profound connection to those who thousands of years ago committed to making Ibiza their home. Ben is also a TEDx speaker. We met on that project here last year when TEDx came to Ibiza for the very first time. And he shares brilliant tips for anyone facing up to some key public speaking challenges, and anyone who has some fear, well, that'll be most of us then. So listen in for that. It's a great conversation which happened overlooking the Mediterranean Sea as the sun beat down upon us. So you'll hear the evocative sounds of Ibiza in the background. I really hope you enjoy this first episode, and please do help get this podcast out to even more people by doing a couple of really easy things. Please do share it on your social channels, and please do leave a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or over on Spotify. It'll mean more people will hear those words, and who knows whose commitment will be helped now and in the future. Okay, over to my Mojo conversation with Ben Dunwell. Welcome back to the Mojo Podcast. And as I said in the intro, I'm in a rather special, beautiful part of Ibiza today, which we'll come to in a second. But firstly, I want to introduce my guest, Ben Dunwell. How are you doing, Ben?
Very well. Thanks very much.
Lovely to see you on. What a cracking day it is in January in Ibiza.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's just such a lovely, calm, sunny moment. Extraordinary.
And on that, I always start here, Ben. So, Mojo, out of 10 today, how are you tracking?
It's pretty high, actually, I'd say. As we've said, it's an amazingly beautiful day. It's really nice to come to this part of the island for me, which I know was sort of leading up to that as well. So I won't give that away too soon. But so actually, it really makes me feel very sort of invigorated to come where we are today. And it's, as I say, a lovely sunny day down by the sea. Kind of just reminds you why we're here, I guess.
And to put you on the spot, what's your number out of 10?
Oh, I'd say it's an 8.5.
Oh, high, very good. And so even in there, you're talking about some things that maybe mojo means to you, that sort of invigoration, that feeling. But dig a little bit deeper. What does that word mean for you, mojo?
Okay, well, I was thinking about this because technically, it's kind of like a sort of magical talisman, source of power type thing. And I quite like the way that the word has sort of slipped from an older meaning into a sort of newer meaning. I quite like it when words make those journeys. But for me, in the sense of it being like a kind of almost like a source of a superpower, I find that my mojo is to do with connection to natural world around us. And actually, my specific mojo, I'd say, and this has really evolved since coming to Ibiza, is the night. That's a sort of a dramatic statement. My mojo is the night. I mean, it's a title of a novel. Let's go for it. but no, what I find is that if I sit out underneath the stars, which I like to do of a night, and you look at the moon and you look at what phase of the moon we're in, you look at which constellations are tracking across at which time of year, I get this really clear sense of connection to the whole sort of great universe around us, but also to all the people who've watched those patterns and transits in the same way. And I kind of feel, I was thinking about this last night actually, big moon going on obviously, and I was thinking that our days now are very different from the days of people who lived 1,000 or so years ago. Our nights are more similar because we kind of gather into homes, we gather towards light, we gather towards warmth, food, and we look out at a dark, which is full of wonder, stroke, fear, whatever it's going to be. But those feelings are probably closer to an ancient feeling than the feelings you're going to get getting up in the morning, jumping in your car and driving off to work. So that sense of connection with the world around us, but also that connection with our ancestors, for me, that's kind of my mojo.
Wow. I love that. And I love, you know, what are we? Series six, 70-odd episodes. Nobody has mentioned anything like that before. Connection, maybe, but nothing around the specifics of it, around the night. So I love that. And I love getting all these unique answers. And what a lovely segue into kind of part of what we're going to talk about today. So I think, should we tell everyone where we are? The big reveal.
Well, it's not that exciting. No. It's a bit exciting. So we're down at Sakaleta, which is the little beach down in the south of Ibiza. And we're here because it's a very lovely spot, but also on that headland is the ancient Phoenician village, the very first Phoenician village where the first settlers came to this island. Which was a commitment in itself, something I'm sure we'll return to. And that's nice for me to come down here because the books that I'm working on, the historical novels that I'm working on about that period of time, are all set largely around this bit of the island.
Okay, so and the books, this is the Pine Island series.
That's right.
Of which I know the first is out, the second is incoming, and we're going to talk about that shortly, and there may be more. We talked about that the other day. I'm so glad we came here as well. I used to live closer to this part of the island, and I always loved coming down here. This, the colour of the water here, obviously the history of it, the red cliffs at Sakaleta, which some people will be aware of, the lovely restaurant there. So I'm very glad we made the trek down here, our commitment to making the podcast today. So, and really, I wanted to, and there's numerous strands I wanted to unpack with you today. I think first, as a writer, and I really wanted to talk to you as a writer, that is commitment. That opening up, you know, a new page on on your MacBook, a blank page in your journal, whatever it might be, and committing to that. Tell me a bit about that and how that works for you.
Well, it's pretty daunting, as I'm sure anyone who's done this will know. Where I started with writing, I started writing for theatre, and then I started going into music theatre and other opera and performance-based stuff. So what we would always do, I was working with a composer, was we would make sure we had the venue booked, and then we would start writing. So in terms of a commitment, there's no way out. There's just a ticking clock, and it's ticking fast. When you work, as I'm now doing, with these longer pieces and prose pieces and novels, actually you have to start creating your own deadlines. And that's where the commitment side of things gets a bit more complicated. If I know that I've got to get this thing ready for a rehearsal next Monday, there's no way I'm going to miss that deadline. So yeah, so when you've got a venue booked for next Friday, you make sure you've got the material in front of the performers in time for that. when you're working on chapter 6 of 12 and there's other things going on in your life and the whole project feels like it's become a bit heavy, and anyway you're on draft 7, and that's when the levels of doubt start to rise, and that's when you need to have a sort of core of something that keeps you going. Now, I mean, for me, I really enjoy the process of writing these books. Also, I feel I'm learning a huge amount as I go along, so which is a lovely thing to do at this time of one's life. Mm. And so I'm kind of driven onwards. Well, driven is a tough word. I'm actually sustained by that feeling of learning something new, and that helps me to keep on recommitting to the project week after week. And it does just take, I mean, I've realized that I'm a slow writer. I wish I was one of these amazing people who could just sit down and dash off a book in 15 weeks and send it off to the publisher and then do another draft and they're done. I'm just not that person. Mm. I have to write the wrong book for a long time before I find the right one. And that is just something I've got to, you know, I've got to know that about myself. I've kind of had to accept it. And it that will change as well. I think that will change with each book that I work on. But it feels to me as if my self-knowledge has to encompass the fact that it's a slow process, and it's kind of incremental and it's experimental, and everything that you do is important for you to do. Everything you write, everything you think, every idea you develop is important, even though they may not make it through to a final draft.
And I'm just really, really struck by that, you know, the importance of the commitment to writing, which is to say, easy for some, not for everybody, but that the self-learning in there and the evolution of your style of writing, and this must be, well, tell me, the potential to compare. Well, this writer seems to, as you say, they can knock out a bestseller in 15 weeks. I just don't do it that way. But there seems to me, there's obviously a self-awareness in there, but almost a self-care. I can't try and be that person because I'm not. And somewhere in there, that's going to make commitment to yourself and what you're doing easier. Is that fair?
I think that's true. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, well, for me, that thing about comparing with other people is something that, thank God, it seems to be sort of falling away as I get a little bit more grown up, because it's exhausting. And I remember being very firmly in the grip of that sort of comparing energy only about sort of 10 years ago, but now much, much less so. I remember that I had a lovely conversation with an opera director called David Edwards, and he said to me that if you can do good work that you enjoy doing with people you like, that is success. It will never get any better than that. Mm. And I that really, really struck home with me. One of the things I do rather miss, actually, in writing these books, is that there's less collaboration. There is still collaboration a bit, and actually when you come towards the end of the process and it goes into publishing and you've got readers with opinions coming back and publishers sort of making edits and things like that, it becomes more collaborative, and that kind of human dynamic springs to life, which is really warming, and you really need it by then. Because actually the first bit's quite lonely, and you can't share stuff if it's not quite right. Your family can't really respond to you saying, yeah, I'm not sure this bit works anymore, because they don't understand what you're talking about, nor do your friends. So you end up in this rather isolated space for quite a long period of time as a novel writer or a long prose writer. So that's something where, yeah, self-care is important. You need to look after yourself. You need to avoid despair, avoid comparison. And yeah, for me, it is always clinging to the moments where you go, God, I suddenly understand how to do that so much better.
So, right. Because I was going to ask you, in those, it's the dark night of the soul when you are by yourself and where is this thing going? And you said, I've got to write the wrong book to get to the right book. What is it that keeps you going? What is it that keeps you committed and recommitted to it? Is this sense of these breakthroughs that you just know with experience will come? And I guess the noticing of them, as you said.
There is an element of noticing them, I think, which is really, really important. There's also, I mean, to be honest, there is a thing about identity in here as well, where what you're saying is, this is what I'm doing. I'm writing this book. And you can say it to the world, but the world might not be terribly interested. The point is you have to say it to yourself, and you have to believe that. And that belief has to sustain you through those tricky bits. And I think there's a really strange and complicated and probably very beautiful dance between ego and humility that I find as a writer, as any kind of creative person, probably as any person. I don't think this is sort of the preserve of artists, but there's that thing where your ego has to drive you a bit, but if your ego drives too hard, then your product starts to go wrong. So there's you're in a constant it's like going for a walk with someone and checking in. Are we going the right place? Are we going the right speed? Do you want to stop here? You're in a dialogue with your ego all the time and just checking that it's not dragging you places where you shouldn't necessarily go. And just to remember that it's not the most important thing in the world. These books come and go. It's all fine. But that it is kind of important to you, to me, that they get written and that they're good.
I love that. It's that balance of the ego and humility, which I agree with you. I think that can apply to everybody and anybody in life, and having, again, that awareness of where am I on that balance. And also get this sense of, yeah, with that, you're holding the project, the commitment to the novel, you're holding it, but not overly tightly. I do get in myself, I know when I hold something really tightly in my hand, oh, this must happen this way, and it must be just like this. It's not going to be much fun, and it might not actually come out the way I intended, but just that slight loosening is what I'm getting from you. Mm. It's still, I want to do this, I'm committed to it, it's important, but there are other things as well. Mm.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think on this island, actually, on Ibiza, I have to let go of things continuously. This doesn't seem to be an island that reacts well to trying to grab hold of stuff. It will challenge you if you hang on too tight. Whereas if you hold things, as you say, a little more loosely, then the island treats you a little more kindly.
Well, I think that's a nice segue, actually, into... well, there's island life now, and island life many, many centuries ago, which you are something of an expert on. And I'd love to just sort of entwine that a little bit and talk about that commitment. What do you notice? Is there a comparison actually between when the ancient Phoenicians rocked up on Ibiza in when was it? What was sort of?
Well, they sort of the accepted date for people turning up here, right here,
where we are.
Exactly, is about 650 BC. So and people tend not to clock how long ago that was. So we're before Rome, very very early Greek states. It's old, that's a long, long way back. So it's in a way, I mean, I picked this subject and this era because it fascinated me, but also because it's such a long way back and it kind of exists before most of the historical fiction that one reads about the Mediterranean could take place. But if you think of the Hollywood version of Mediterranean history, like, you know, Russell Crowe in Gladiator, lots of swords, lots of sandals, and for me that kind of historical fiction isn't that. I mean, I love it, don't get me wrong, I absolutely love it, but I'm intrigued by another version of historical fiction which looks much harder into the hearts of the real people who were here. Because my hunch, and it is a bit of a hunch, is that a lot of the emotions and drives and reactions, responses, dreams, fears, nightmares, desires, cravings, would not have been that different. How they manifest now is very different from how they manifested then, but the drives are remarkably similar. So what you can do when you write about that period is you can create this rather interesting, beautiful, very early society here, but populated with a whole load of emotions and sensations which are designed, if I'm honest, to be rather familiar to anyone who lives here or who has arrived here in the last, you know, how many years, has chosen to make the journey to Ibiza to settle it. And actually, if you read the books as a newcomer to Ibiza, there should be moments where you go, oh my God, I know that feeling. what I'm trying to do is continually make these connections between a modern reader and an ancient character, so that you're drawn kind of into their story, but you're also drawn into your own story as well at the same time.
And what you don't often think that empathy can stretch centuries and millennia, but it sounds like it can, to have those same, as you say, those same feelings and drives, different context, but a lot of the same things going on for us.
I would say so. I mean, I think the human brain responds in certain ways, and you and I are sitting on these little rocks looking out over a calm sea with the sun glittering on it, looking out towards a sort of hazy cape of forested hills, and we can't see much that's human-made from here, to be honest. And I think the sensation that we are having is not that dissimilar from a moment of rest for someone who was here 2,500 years ago, walking down this little path to this little cove to push out a fishing boat or to chuck out some nets or whatever they were going to do. They would walk down and they would stop on this rock, look at that path of sunlight and go, wow, that's beautiful. And then they would carry on. Mm. And that is a connection that we have across thousands of years.
Mm. And there's something, I think there's something very healthy in that as well. There's this thing about being in nature because it's bigger than me, but as being in this nature here, this scene, it's been here for so long, and it will be here for so long. And yes, there's change, but as you said, what we're looking at, there's hardly anything man-made really in front of us, which is absolutely delicious.
It is. It's one of the things that I absolutely love about this island. There are so many places where you can go and time travel. And actually, that's really hard to find in many, many other locations which have this sort of rich history. There's just an awful lot of other stuff around. Whereas in Ibiza, you can find these places where you can just let your mind drift back. And I find that enormously comforting, actually, to be part of a really long story which is full of people just like me. I find that enormously comforting.
Yeah, I get that as well, because we get very, obviously, into our day-to-day and things that are going on and plans that are coming off and not coming off, and you know that can cause joy and it can cause stress. But there is this bigger picture, and I sort of think about it, and I've lived on this island for 5.5 years. I don't know how long I'll be here for, hopefully much, much longer, but it will keep on going. And there is a comfort in that, and just and your part in it as well, I think, and what you're leaving and legacy and all those kind of things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is that thing that this island has, a its entire history really is about people coming and building lives here, and then that changing, and the next people coming, and the next people coming, and there are, it's sort of continuous waves, some of which have been marked by forms of war and aggression, some of which have actually happened very peacefully. There does seem to be a thing where the island sort of reasserts its own idea of what it is over anyone who comes to live here. I think that's quite an interesting sort of pattern, that this island seems to know what it wants to be.
Oh, right. Just when you think, oh, we've got Ibiza sussed, the island turns around and says, no. Yeah, yeah. This is how it's going to be. Well, I think there's lots of maybe more modern stories of people coming with an idea, and maybe what I was talking about earlier, that sort of fixed idea of this is what my life is, or my business is going to be, or this building is going to look like, and the island energy going, no, I don't think so.
Yeah, no. I and one of the things that I really love about working with Martin Davies at Barbary Press is that his insistence that anything that we publish comes out in Spanish and English simultaneously. And that's obviously, it's a lot more work in the preparation of the books. And we've got a lovely translator, Eva Rios, who does an amazing job. But what I really like is the commitment that actually signals from us, from Martin and myself, towards making sure that this story belongs to the whole island rather than just being a thing written by an English guy for English people or, you know, people who read in English to have. And actually, I really noticed when the first book came out in Spanish, I'd lived in San Juan for 8 years by then, and a whole load of people who had never said hello started saying hello to me. It was really lovely.
Ah, right.
Just like, you know, the little old Spanish lady who I had always nodded to as she wandered down the street in San Juan. Yeah. It was a nod and a good morning. And there was a marked shift when that book came out in Spanish.
Right. Well, it is, I'm sure, part of your commitment to the island and you're telling the story. I know it's a fiction, but it's based on the history of the island, which no one else had done. And it sounds to me like that embedded you more with the island, which is something that I think a lot of people actually struggle with. I'm, you know, as I said, we've been here 5.5 years. I'd like to be here longer, but there is a sort of this ebb and flow of, am I being pulled or am I being pushed? And it's things like that commitment, I think, that help.
Mm, definitely, definitely. It's a hugely complicated island, I think, in terms of its history and where the population of its indigenous, its local population, I would say, not indigenous really, and where they find themselves at the moment, I think it's a really, really complex picture. But it's really important, I think, for me anyway, to make sure that these stories, if I'm going to work with the material that this island is offering, then I need to be giving it back to the island somehow as well.
And there's just there's a little anecdote you shared with me before about Ibiza's history as a party island, going back. Could you just share that for everybody?
Oh, well, there's also, and there are lots of lovely stories about this kind of thing, and there's a lot of stories about Bes, who's sort of the party god. He's a little Egyptian dwarf god, and he's obviously related to Ibiza. But the one that I quite like is that I read somewhere that when the Roman legions were being sent home from Gaul, so you'd have a terrible time fighting in Gaul in horrible weather, or even as far as Britain, if you were really unlucky, you know, you'd have to go there. But on the way back, before you got back to Rome, they would often give returning Roman legions a little bit of time out on Ibiza to just depressurize, sit on the beach, drink a load of very, very strong wine, do all sorts of awful things, and then go home, possibly, you know, having let off their steam. So it does, but it has always had this kind of strange shape-shifting quality, I think, Ibiza, for the people who come here. And part of that is about sensation and pleasure.
I love that. And I think, you know, anyone who's listening who's spent some time here will relate, you know, again, from modern times back to Roman days, and the allure of the island, and it certainly is that. And I just wanted to, again, to shift up a little bit. We're talking about commitment to the island and community and what we as the more recent incomers can do. And there was a project that we both collaborated on last year, happening again this year, and that is the TEDx Delt Vila project, which you were a speaker at last year, Ben. I'd love to just to get into your commitment to that as well, because that was a big deal.
Yeah, I did the talk last year, which I really enjoyed doing that. And I have to say, it was when I first thought, okay, I'll go for that, and I was asked to do a talk, I wasn't really sure what the talk was going to be about. I knew that it would be something around the books and history and the past. And I worked on it, and gradually it became clear to me that what I had here was the opportunity to really clarify what I was doing with the writing, with these books, in a way that I hadn't done quite consciously before. And so what I found I was working on was like, it was like a manifesto for what I'm trying to do right now with this series of books. And that was the most valuable thing that I could have done at that time, actually, in the writing process. So it was it proved that unexpected additional, you know, bits of obligation, the moments where we think, oh God, I wish I hadn't done that, suddenly turn rather magically into the thing you absolutely needed to do. Which so the talk that I ended up doing was this thing that I was exploring about our connections with our ancestors and how that helps us to feel less anxious in our modern lives. That sense of being in a wider pattern, that sense of being in a community, a community of the dead. Actually a line from it's popped into my head again. Who we are depends on which of the dead we choose to live among. And for me, choosing to live among the dead who are around us now on this headland, on this island, has been a source of great, great comfort and also a source of great learning.
And in terms of, you said, you know, kind of, you're asked to get involved with it, and you were actually our first speaker, which I thought, you know, that takes a certain, as they say in Spain, a certain cojones to be first up and lead off and set the tone. So obviously this idea kind of came to you. Tell me a bit about the, and you've talked about your writing process. Was it a similar process in terms of, you know, this is a, I can't remember exactly how long you did, a sort of a 10 to 12 minute, obviously, talk, no notes, no prompts. That's the kind of the TEDx rules. How did it develop for you as a process?
Well, I think for me, the breakthrough was when I stopped writing it and started speaking it. So I had a kind of script that was working okay, but it sort of felt a bit stilted. It felt a bit contrived in places, and then there were elements in it which were being a bit sort of listening to the sound of its own voice because it hadn't quite worked out what it was trying to say. And what I found an absolute breakthrough, which I've never done in any other realm of writing before, was to just perform it to camera and record that and look back and see what worked and what didn't. And I suddenly found that if I was just speaking, things would start to link together in a much more coherent and sort of emotionally sensible way than if I was writing it down on the page. So it became more like a conversation, and that's when for me the talk came alive, and also when I started to feel that I could really enjoy the process of giving the talk, because I was very familiar with the feeling of voicing it rather than reading it.
Yeah, that's great advice for anyone. I mean, not everyone's obviously doing a TED talk tomorrow, but we're doing presentations, we're doing short introductions to people and things. And, you know, public speaking is something that most people would prefer to walk into the path of a fast car than actually get up on stage and do any kind of public speaking. So it says a lot. And what about, how did you, because I mentioned no notes, you know, tend to be allowed. How did you commit all that, you know, all these words that you'd created, how did you commit that to memory?
Well, I've got a bit of a trick for that, actually, which I've sort of carried over from more performing days, which is about acknowledging that I forget stuff. And I especially forget stuff when I'm a bit nervous or something unexpected happens. So what I do is I learn it. And like, say, for the TED talk, which was, I think it was only about 9 minutes, really, 9 and a half. But for me, learning it meant that I could do the whole thing in one take to camera without any glitches or mistakes. So I got myself to that point, and then I allowed myself to kind of forget it. And then I went through that whole process a second time. And I got myself to the point where I could learn it and do the whole thing in one take to camera. And then I kind of let that drift as well. And so a week goes by, and then you do it a third time. So then you've got like strata of sort of almost like a muscular memory of what it feels like to speak it. And the reason I think it's really useful is that you go out on stage and you're nervous. It's quite scary. And you stand on the red dot and they shine bright lights in your face. And that's the first moment where you kind of forget the last time you learnt it. But luckily, you've got the time underneath that. And so you fall into the arms of the time before that you learnt it. Then something goes wrong. And so then you forget everything again. But you've got another safety net underneath you again. So for me, once you've got three layers of learning, you are pretty safe. And if I'm absolutely honest, I had it printed out on a piece of paper in my back pocket as well. Though I knew that I wasn't really allowed to take that out. But emotionally, yeah, it helped.
Yeah, I get that. A kind of security that it's there if, yeah, if I
well,
desperately...
Well, to be honest, I knew that if everything went wrong, I could pull that out and give the audience in the room the speech and the talk, so they would have it. And then it might not be allowed to be up on TED Heaven. But, you know, I would have done it all right on the day. So, yes. Yeah. But I for anyone memorising stuff, for me, if it's something that you're not familiar with, I think... just give yourself enormous amounts of time, because sometimes in our modern life we react to stress by shortening our exposure to it, so we don't do the thing. It's like, oh, that's stressful. It is sort of prevarication.
Sort of move away from it.
It's like, oh, I don't want to. That feels stressful. I'm not going to do it now. I'll do it tomorrow. I will learn it. I will learn it. And actually, you've got to start, because it takes a long time.
That, I mean, and that in itself is great advice. You've got to start. You know, there is no perfect. There's, you know, the Chinese proverb: the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is today.
Yeah,
you've got to get on with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, I would say the same thing with writing. I mean, I've spent many years of my life trying to create or find or imagine the perfect writing environment. And actually, what I've found is that wherever you are, you have to be able to do it. It's a mindset, the writing environment. And part of that mindset involves being prepared to do it literally anywhere. I mean, I find it really hard to write on public transport. I don't know why. It's sort of like it's a different headspace I go into. They don't match across. But other than that, you know, I've as anyone who's, you know, tried to bring up kids on this island, you spend most of your time in the car and with sort of half hour breaks in between things. And I've quite happily set up a little office in the back of my truck where I can sort of sit on the tailgate and write there for 40 minutes, because that's where I am.
And I love that, because for me there's you know, talking about commitment, and sometimes it's hard to make commitments, but I think often, as you said, we create barriers, either the ones in our head, this is stressful, I don't want to do it, or no, I'm just really busy today, I'm driving around, I can't possibly. And there you are, you finding a way to make it work for you to commit to, I want to write, I don't know, 1,000 words today. This is how I'm going to get it done. I love that. And I always like to get into this sort of area towards the end of the conversation. And I think you're kind of getting there with writing for you. It sounds like a ritual.
Yeah.
And it's something that needs to be, you know, a habit, essentially, to really work for you. And I'd love to get a sense of what habits or practices or rituals you have almost on a daily basis that coming back to mojo and commitment, that just helping you achieve what you want to achieve.
It's funny little things, isn't it? I mean, I am a massive fan of ritual, obviously, with all my sort of like looking into our past where there would be a much more ritualized way of living. Although I actually believe that our modern way of living is also intensely ritualized. It's just we don't quite see it in the same way. But it, for me, I mean, it's things like I have found since I came to this island a really good coffee pot. It makes a damn good espresso. And there's so many, but like some of them, they don't quite work. They don't open nicely. You can't wash them easily. They don't quite. There's always. Anyway, I found one that I love. And if I can, and my family laugh at me for this, and they're quite right to, but if I can just clean that up and lay it out the night before, so that when I come down in the morning, it just goes chunk, chunk, chunk. It's not really about speed. It's not really about efficiency. It's about intention. It's about knowing the night before I'm saying it's okay, because when I get up, I know that I'm already walking into this space. And in this space, there will, first of all, be my lovely coffee, but then also there will be creativity, growth, thinking forward, being excited by ideas, staying open, keeping flexible, being caffeinated, all these things. But the ritual sets an intention. And we all do this in different ways in our modern lives.
I And for me, I'm getting this sense of, and I sort of read about this concept recently, this is a pre-commitment. Because your commitment is, I make a coffee for myself. It sets me up for my day and all those amazing adjectives that you were sharing in terms of what your space needs to be and how you need to be, your intention. And the pre-commitment is, I do a simple thing. I wash everything up and lay it out, and I'm ready.
Yeah.
And I'm going to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the one thing about writing big bits of work like books is that you do need to keep moving forward. You do need quite a chunk of time. You were saying, 1,000 words a day. That's pretty good. I like to get in a little bit above that if I can. And you do need to make that space work for you. So that level of pre-commitment, the creating the intention, it's actually essential. And if I hit a day where I haven't quite managed to clear that path, I have to accept that day may not go quite how I want it to.
Love it. And Ben, how can people find the book that's out now? When is the new book coming out? And how else can people connect with you?
Oh, well, gosh, the marketing. Here we go. So the book is, it's called Pine Tree Island, the first one, or Isla de Pinos in Castellano. And that is in a lot of the little papeleria bookshops. And there are some in, when the restaurants are open, Juntos and La Paloma, Galleria Elefante. It's out in little outlets. It's on Amazon as well. You can buy a hard copy. We've got a Kindle version on Amazon and recently an Audible version up as well. So we're pretty specced up, actually. And the second one, which is it's in good shape, actually. I think I've pretty much come to the point of the draft where I'm going to be able to give it to Martin, the publisher. And then we move forward. That's a slow process because then it's translation and putting it into sort of production and stuff like that. So it'll be a while yet, but the book is effectively written. So that's great. And also there is this feeling that, I know for this particular story, there is a third book that finishes the whole tale off. Although somewhere at the back of my head, I'm observing a sort of book two and a half. So we've done book one, that's out, that's Pine Tree Island. Second book, can't give you a title yet because that'll come from Martin a little bit later. But that's sort of done. And then the third one is mapped out in my head. But book two and a half is one that may happen in between, which is a sort of, it'll be from the same era and the same sort of story of the people on the island, but it just has a slightly different angle to it.
Wow. Okay, so watch this space then in terms of the progression of the Pine Tree Island series.
Indeed.
Well, Ben, I mean, looking out on our Pine Tree Island across this beautiful bay, I just want to thank you so much for coming onto the Mojo podcast and sharing your story.
Well, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure.
There we go. What a great way to kick off the new series. Thanks so much, Ben. Now, I tend to use these final few words as some kind of summary of the conversation. Now, from the off, I loved what Ben talked about as what Mojo means for him, this sense of really being connected and how profound that's been for him as he's connected to those in the past. You can feel that empathy that this connection creates for him and his work. And also how Ben faced that particular fear, the blank sheet of paper, and remembers that the reward he creates for himself is that he'll be learning something new, and that allows him to move past any blockages and fear and put his words onto paper. And I loved his tips about learning your lines for any kind of public performance, be that acting, giving a TED talk, or that presentation to a new client who's coming in next week. Practice and forget three times to truly lock it in. Brilliant. So many more conversations like this coming your way every fortnight, and that's my commitment. Now, please remember to give the Mojo podcast some love with a 5-star rating, a review, and share with your network. And you can find out more about how to rediscover your mojo over at mojo-leadership.com, where we coach individuals and deliver workshops for teams. Okay, until next time, I hope your mojo continues to flow.